around the north of modern-day Khorasan province. For various reasons, this peace-loving, serene tribe have had to move here, the southeast of Iran, and lived in peace since. Shir Muhammad Baluch is one of the original members of the old Sham village. But today, the village is nothing more than a collection of abandoned buildings where he can rest during sizzling hot days. This is amazing. They place one lantern and both families lived under the light of that one lantern. There isn't much left of the old Sham village, but even the ruins of it speak of the very rich culture of the kind, hospitable Baluch people. One of the structures that has stood the test of time is the beautiful mosque of Old Sham, built by the very hands of those who inhabited the village many years ago. It's gotten unbearably hot by now. I am kilometers away from the coast of the Sea of Oman in Baluchistan. But that distance is not going to keep me from a much-needed dive on the golden sand beach. The difference between the temperatures in Iran's climate zones is incredible, and to many, unbelievable. I'm in the southeasternmost part of Iran, swimming in the Sea of Oman in the middle of winter. On this same day, some of my mountaineer friends climbing up Mount Damavand tell me the temperature where they are is around minus 30 degrees. That's a difference of 60 degrees between two areas of Iran. I've done my swimming, and now I've decided to travel to the southeastern end of Iranian territory. That's the Gwadar Bay, located in the Gulf of Oman on the maritime border of Iran and Pakistan. A lot of fish is caught and brought to shore here. Many large trawler launches unload their catches on smaller boats on the shore. Before they arrive in Iranian territory, the fish coming from those launches are purchased by middlemen and transported to big cities around the country. The main purpose of my trip to Gwadar Bay is to see the beautiful Hara mangrove forest in this border area. Hara is a species of the Lantana genus. The seeds from the tree fall into the water, where wave action takes them to more stationary parts of the sea. The Hara seeds become fixed in the soil layers of the sea and grow. Taro trees are saltwater plants that are often submerged at high tide. They are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and a complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They are adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. We are now exactly at the mouth of Khore Bahu. This is the zero point that separates Iran from Pakistan. We are about to enter a very beautiful river. As a matter of fact, it's a khore or firth. It's not a river. And it continues a long way in that direction. Khore Bahu is in fact a bay area created by water from the Sea of Oman. This is the last spot before you actually arrive in the sea itself. Before the firth, there is the Bahu Kalat River that flows from Sarbaz Mountains to the Gulf of Oman. This is it. I can see the mountains of Pakistan vividly from here. Pakistan is located right on the other side of the Hara Forest. A lot of birds and fish live here in this firth, which, as I said, was created by salty waters from the Sea of Oman. It's a very beautiful area. The Hara forests spanning this area are indeed unique. The Hara tree grows to heights of 6 meters and has bright green leaves and twigs. It is a species of the mangrove tree that can grow in coastal saline or brackish water. They have a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. The Hara excludes salt by having significantly impermeable roots, which are highly impregnated with suberin, acting as an ultrafiltration mechanism to exclude sodium salts from the rest of the plant. Hara trees grow in 8 protected areas in Iran and are fortunately looked after by both the authorities and people. The Hara forests in the south of Iran are a major habitat for migratory birds in the cold season, and for reptiles, fish, and varieties of bivalves. Green or hooked turtles and venomous aquatic snakes are also indigenous to the forests. Bird life includes herons, flamingos, pelicans, and angler eagles. Another important feature of these forests is the appropriate and suitable seabed conditions for the ovulation of fish in the Persian Gulf. The locals say you are very likely to run into a school of dolphins passing Gwadar Bay on your way to see the Hara forests. But looks like I'm down on my luck today. There are still many villages in Baluchistan that have weathered the storm of time and preserved their traditional look. But the way to visit one of them is to seek guidance from a local guide. And that person is none other than my very own friend, Shir Muhammad. We have a long way ahead of us to the village we have decided to visit. To get there, we have to drive on a vast plain. There are no paved roads, not so much as a dirt track. The name of the village is Nilay. Baluchistan is a very dry province. It rains very little here. As a result, not very long ago, the people of Baluchistan would dig a catchment to accumulate what little rainwater that fell from the sky. Those catchments acted as their only water reservoirs. They called them hutags. The importance of drinking water is not lost on anyone nowadays. Aware of the shortage of this vital liquid, countries around the world have embarked on preserving and conserving drinking water in recent years. The best way to prevent water from going to waste in a country like Iran that's facing a severe water problem is changing the consumption pattern. Put it simply, every human being needs only 10 liters of water to wash their whole body. But most of us keep the water running while having a shower and let something between 100 and 200 liters of precious drinking water go into the septic tank. Nowadays, most of us think that to keep our yards clean, we have to wash them with tap water every week. While in the past, although the problem of water was not as serious in Iran as it is now, and the population was not as big, people would clean their yards with sprinkles of water and a broom. And the purpose was to prevent dust from rising when sweeping. In the past, there weren't as many cars that needed to be washed with drinking water every few days. But today, millions of liters of water is consumed every year to wash the millions of vehicles across the country. I came to realize the importance of drinking water in recent years. On one of my trips to this same Baluchistan region, I ended up bathing with only 3 liters of water after going without a wash for a whole week. It was a time when the people here were grappling with a drought. That incident led me to understand the importance of drinking water in Iran. I now understand why we shouldn't let even a single drop of it go to waste. This is one of the oldest houses in this whole area. In this whole village. And Haji Khodabakhsh was in fact born in this same house. He's giving me a tour of the interior. The houses in the village of Nilag are beautiful and traditional. But there is one house in this village that is very old, very beautiful, and unique. In Baluchi language, this house is called a kud. It is dark in the house. There is no electricity, no running water, and not even a room. This is all there is to it. The owner says that all the members of the family, and there were 9 of them, used to live together in this house that is no more than one big lounge. But despite all the deprivations, the members of the family are as close as ever. The Baluch are a very kind, family-loving people. I feel an eerie feeling of calm among these pure souls. Baluch hospitality makes any stranger visiting these parts feel at home in their houses. You feel like you were born and raised in one of these houses and lived a good, simple life growing up with these genial and warm people. Most of the Baluch people who don't go fishing at sea are herders, and in this area, camels are the best livestock to keep. Camels have adapted very well to the environment and climate of Baluchistan. My journey is coming to an end. Sheer Muhammad tells me about one of his friends. Mr. Shah Bash is one of the main camel herders in the region. The old camel rider tells me about Baluch kindness towards all of the world's creatures. Kindness embedded in the culture of this people. The Baluch are a very kind and passionate people, traits that are evident in the words of Mr. Shah Bash. When I ask him if he's ever tried camel meat, he says the Baluch normally do not eat camel. That's because camels are loved by these people, and so they don't have the heart to slaughter them, much less eat their meat. I have arrived at the end of my trip, a trip that taught me many valuable lessons about the Baluch people and Baluchistan. This is a province with a beautiful, unspoiled environment, a place where the sea meets the mountains and plains. The Baluch people, with their rich ancient culture, are a source of great pride for Iran. I, too, am proud of these honest, kind people. Proud of having such generous fellow countrymen and women. The Sea of Oman looks like a drop of water against the unfathomable hearts of these people. All I want for the people here is proper, stable jobs compatible with their culture and environment, created by competent and caring government officials. I hope for facilities and development to come to this part of my country without doing any damage to its ancient culture and pristine environment. We'll be right back.
Well, perhaps Iran's internationally renowned mosques and ancient remnants of Isfahan and Shiraz are what attracts most visitors from far and wide, but I'm sure many nature-loving individuals have become interested in visiting Iran's southernmost region and the pristine natural wonders of Sistan and Baluchistan. And that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. Goodbye for now.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful, we send our peace and blessings upon all the prophets of Allah, Subhanahu wa Taala. And especially the last of them, Muhammadul Mustafa and his progeny, and those companions who followed their path. I'm your host, Sayyid Wahid Alawi, and welcome to another program of For a Better Life, here on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about psychological diseases and social issues, social problems that we might have in the society and within ourselves. Mental suffering that we are talking about right now. Basically, man's creation is such that he is compelled to bear a lot of physical and spiritual hardships in order to satisfy the needs of his life. Because it is in the course of this toil and hardship and endeavor for obtaining the material means of life that his intellectual and spiritual faculties acquire their growth. Without any difficulties, dear brothers and sisters, we would not evolve. We would not develop, neither spiritually, nor mentally, nor physically. When you want to carry weight, you go to bodybuilding and you carry those weights and you try to make your muscles bigger, have them in a certain form or shape. But by doing so, you have to go through suffering. You have to go through hardship. You have to carry those weights when you go to the gym. Otherwise, your muscles will not grow. Your muscles will not develop. It's the same thing here, dear brothers and sisters. We have to learn and exercise so that we can elevate our concentration and focus and attention. We have to exercise so we can elevate our spiritual well-being. It is in this course of toil and hardship that human beings can attain their goals and acquire the growth that is needed. Hardship and suffering, the wisdom with hardship and suffering, dear brothers and sisters, has a profound and extensive influence in our life. If Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala would not put hardship and suffering in our life, we would not have tasted the sweet joy of reaching that certain goal that we have in our mind, or that certain physique that we have in our mind. Everything comes with hardship. That is the wisdom behind any hardship, that you can elevate yourself physically, mentally, and spiritually. And if hardship would not exist, those things would not exist. When a sprinter wants to become the number one sprinter of the world, what does that person do? Exercises daily. When you want to be the number one student in your class or in the university, what do? You study hard. Stay up until early morning and study and study to become the number one. Hardship and suffering is within human life. The spiritual powers of great men receive their burnish under the stress of calamities and shine forth better than ever in the darkness of adversity. Do remember Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. His face was glowing the closer he came towards his own death, his own shahada. the maqatil, the historians who were there, writing down what they saw, what they were witnessing, were saying that his face was glowing more and more the closer he came to his shahada. He was reaching elevation, and the more hardship he suffered, the more he was elevated, and the higher level you reach in paradise.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor, cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
The spiritual powers of great men, all of our mystics, imams, and the prophets of Allah had to go through it. And the harder the test or the exam was, the higher level they reached. Had not man, since the first days of his existence, not felt wretched on account of his ignorance, he would not have made any effort to obtain relief from these difficulties, and would have languished in the darkness, undeveloped, would have languished in ignorance and savageness. All our development, our technology, our mental and spiritual well-being, all of this comes with effort, with hardship. And we would not have seen today any trace of the manifestations of our own intellect, morality, and spirituality. It is the painful feeling of being ignorant that made man make an unrelenting struggle against ignorance, jahl. The all-round advancement of man and the foundations of all this progress in our civilization, our society matters, and social matters are based on this truth. Most of the great social movements that we have seen in human history that were a point of departure for human progress and the leap towards human edification were the consequence of crushing hardships and difficulties. Although these adversities are bitter in appearance and pleasures and joys are pleasing and attractive, the matter is in reality quite the opposite. Because the pursuit of pleasures and lust leads to decadence, immorality, and disaster, whereas adversities and hardships carry in their bosom felicity, sa'ada, and success, tawfiq. You know, dear brothers and sisters, whenever you have accomplished your goal, how does it feel? I'm asking you right here and now, how does it feel when you have accomplished a very difficult and hard goal? You reached a conclusion, you reached a result, and you feel satisfied with yourself. You feel happy, you feel joy. Why? Because those hardships that you felt through this journey to reaching that goal. It might be a sprinter, a basketball player, an athlete, actor, whatever you do in your career, in the university, in your family, within the family activities that you have, being a good spouse, being a good child, it takes hardship. Being a good parent, all of that takes hardship. It is a struggle. To be a good son and daughter, it is a struggle. Likewise, to be a good parent, it is a struggle. So there is a definite interrelation between experience of suffering and attainment of felicity. There is a cause and effect relation between hardships and adversities. And I will talk more about this, inshallah ta'ala, in future programs. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
Oh.
All I need to be all I need, and I know that you see how much you mean to me. Cause your love is all I need to be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me. Cause your love is all I need.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
The Debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, as both the U.S. and the U.K. Talk about non-proliferation for other countries, both of them plan on improving their nuclear warheads. A report by The Guardian says there will be an increase in the number of warheads that the U.K. possesses. Meanwhile, Washington is reportedly going ahead with a massive $100 billion program to upgrade and modernize its nuclear missiles, this coming from the only country which has ever used nuclear weapons against a civilian population, the United States.
For the first time since the end of the Cold War, the United Kingdom is planning on increasing its stockpile of nuclear warheads. A report by The Guardian says a review of defense and foreign policy would see an increase of the number of warheads, which currently stands at 180. The review is set to be released next week. The last defense review in 2015 committed the UK to reducing the number of operationally available warheads to 120. The increase is said to be aimed at persuading the US to co-fund a replacement for UK nuclear weapons, also known as a Trident nuclear program. Britain has been heavily dependent on US technology to operate its nuclear weapons in the past 60 years. Observers believe Britain wants to convey to Washington that the UK is still part of the US hegemonic apparatus.
This is a desperate attempt to shore up Britain's fading prestige on the world stage as a major power and trying to prove to Washington that it is still part of Washington's hegemonic apparatus and is still a valued partner. It is no secret that the Biden administration looks poorly on Brexit. And this is a desperate attempt, as I say, to compensate for the ravages of Brexit.
The United Kingdom is not the only country looking to expand its nuclear arsenal. Just days ago, reports came out that the United States, which already possesses nearly 6,000 warheads, is also planning on building a new nuclear missile worth $100 billion. The Federation of American Scientists says that this plan is being driven by intense industry lobbying rather than a clear assessment of the purpose of the new intercontinental ballistic missile. This is while the Biden administration is gearing up for the first defense budget, which may reveal its intentions as regards the nuclear missile. Also, Israel is believed to possess hundreds of nuclear warheads, though it has never openly acknowledged it. Tel Aviv has always turned a deaf ear to international calls for nuclear transparency. With the support of the United States and other Western countries, the occupying regime has even refused to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Both the United States and the UK are signatories to the NPT. As parties to the treaty, they have pledged not to acquire or exercise control over nuclear weapons or receive assistance in the manufacture of such devices. The Western states' possession of such nuclear arsenal raises the question as to why they are pressuring other countries like Iran not to develop nuclear capabilities for civilian purposes. This is while multiple reports by the International Atomic Energy Agency have verified the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program. All in all, with the U.S. being the only country that has used nuclear weapons against another nation and its massive use of depleted uranium weapons at civilian areas in Iraq and Syria, one would argue the legitimacy of the West to possess nuclear weapons.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this debate from the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament and Stop the War Coalition, Jim Brand, out of London, and co-director of International Action Center, Sarah Flanders, out of New York. Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off in London. And Jim, why do you think that the UK is planning to increase the number of its nuclear warheads, especially when the country is going through such a major economic pressure? Why now?
Well, I'm surprised that it's actually planning to increase the number of warheads. So that came as news to me. But the general line that Britain is increasing its military spending, for example, there was a surprise announcement about 3 or 4 months ago that came completely out of the blue, where Prime Minister Boris Johnson announced an extra £16 billion for so-called defence spending on top of the regular budget. And that's consistent with a whole trend in recent years. And for example, this year, in a couple of months' time, they're going to be sending a British aircraft carrier, one of these brand new aircraft carriers, to the Pacific. And it's interesting to note that it will be escorted by a United States warship, and it will carry on it, the aircraft carrier will carry on it, half its complement will be from the United States Marine Corps Air Force. So that shows you the extent to which Britain is dependent, even for its so-called independent aircraft carrier, on the United States, and needs to come under the wing of the United States if it's to follow its trajectory for the last, basically since the end of the Second World War. And its nuclear policy fits in with that. So in general, it's not a surprise, although I am shocked they're actually going to increase the number of warheads. As far as the money goes, I'm afraid there seems to be no object.
Let me turn to get Sarah in on this conversation. The U.S. is also in the middle of a pandemic and major economic strain. Under the Trump administration, announced the increase of $100 billion upgrade to its nuclear weapons. Why is that the case? Why is that a priority in your perspective?
The U.S. military budget is an enormous, spectacular, multi-billion dollar subsidy to the largest U.S. corporations. And every single year, under both Republican and Democratic administrations, the U.S. defense budget grows 3 to 5%, and always with a new excuse of modernizing weapons, whether it's aircraft carriers, jet aircraft, nuclear weapons, and it's intense lobbying among the different major defense contractors. Now, the Biden administration, their top appointees come directly from the top defense lobbying corporations, the West Exec Advisors, the Pine Island Capital Partners. These are defense lobbyists, and that's where General Austin, retired General Austin, and Blinken, Secretary of State, come directly from. So yes, they want to increase the budget because nothing else right now in the U.S. is making money. So this is guaranteed profit. It puts the whole world at risk. It's complete hypocrisy that this is needed for defense. Of course, it would end life on this planet. And it's a completely insane and yet profitable. That is what drives it. And it is what is driving Britain right now as a junior partner of the U.S., having cut ties with Brexit. Where are they going to go in the world except to be the junior partner tagging along and also bankrupting the people of Britain, the working people? Just like the working people here who desperately, desperately need help, and instead it's going to a huge new handout, modernizing nuclear weapons. What an outrage to the entire world.
Jim, why do you think we not hear an outcry from international agencies such as NPT or International Atomic Energy Agency about these proposed upgrades of these weapons of mass destruction by the U.S. and the U.K.?
You cannot find a more consistent example of complete hypocrisy on the part of the nuclear powers regarding the question of nuclear weapons. You can't do it. For example, we are now 75 years since the first meeting of the United Nations General Assembly, which occurred in London, in a bomb-ravaged London, 5 months after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the United Nations General Assembly met in London before any other institution of the United Nations had been established. There was no General Secretary, the Security Council hadn't been convened. The UN General Assembly met in London, and resolution number one of the United Nations General Assembly of January 1946 was concerning the abolition of nuclear weapons. And October that year, a few months later, British Cabinet Committee met in secret and decided to go ahead with building a British atomic bomb for reasons of British power, and they explained that there was no other reason for it, and also relations with the United States. That's how things have remained for 75 years. Last month, January this year, the nuclear ban treaty came into effect. And that's the vast majority of the world backing the abolition of nuclear weapons. The call of 75 years ago that nuclear weapons must be abolished. So there's total hypocrisy. You can't find any standard of US, Britain, and to a different extent other nuclear powers. You can't find anything but hypocrisy. Nothing makes sense. Unless you understand that nuclear weapons are a weapon of blackmail, they're not a weapon of defense, they're not a weapon of deterrence, they're a weapon of big power blackmail with the supposed right to blow the world up.
What about that, Sarah? You heard what our guest in London said. There's nothing more hypocritical than the way these countries and also so-called international agencies respond in dealing with nuclear weapons or nuclear proliferation. Your take on that, and why do you think that is the case? Because we see a vast difference in the way some countries are treated. We're talking about UK and US tonight. And then on the other hand, we have a country such as Iran with a peaceful nuclear program that is treated totally opposite on the other end of the spectrum.
Well, I couldn't agree more. It is absolute hypocrisy. The US threatens the world with first strike nuclear weapons, including countries that have no nuclear defense. And it is the greatest hypocrisy, the charges against Iran developing nuclear energy, and for that, sanctioning Iran. Now, the sanctions against Iran predate Iran developing any form of nuclear energy. The sanctions on Iran have always been an effort to regain U.S. control and domination of Iran, has no other purpose. And even tacking on Iran developing nuclear energy, as if that's a great threat, it's a very important part of modern industrialization, and charging that that's a nuclear weapon, while this building of nuclear weapons continues unabated, modernization, new generation, the nuclear weapons of Israel, the nuclear weapons of the surrounding countries. It's complete hypocrisy. Everyone understands it, but the U.S. is a big threat, so of course international and U.N. agencies go along with what is a total charade in the most outrageous, really, way, and a complete, this is a theft of world resources on a huge scale, when you're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. And I want to say the whole defense budget in the U.S., not only nuclear weapons, is enormous, enormous theft of resources. They'll spend, yes, almost $2 trillion in 30 years' time on nuclear weapons, but they'll spend in 2 years that on the defense budget, which is all kinds of other weapons all thrown in. Different corporations are vying for the contracts, and that's what you see being played out in the media. But none of them want to let go of these guaranteed profits. And that is what it's about. It is about profits, a direct subsidy from the U.S. government, from the British government, to big contractors. It's not about anything else. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly not about peace. It's not about ending nuclear weapons. It's about more weapons.
Well, how dangerous is that, Sarah? It's profit. You just said profit. So profit over people's lives. I mean, where do we stand with that? It's as if these entities are basically rogue states and will do whatever they want at any time because of the dollar.
They are rogue states. They're rogue states to their own population. Here is the U.S. with the highest COVID infection and death rate in the world. And the U.S. and Britain are neck and neck in terms of percentage of the population suffering infection and death. And yet they have billions to spend on direct handouts to the biggest corporations. Yet for the population itself, is there the tracking? Is there the tracing? Is there the vaccines available? Is there the health care available? There's simply not. Mm-hmm. Is there the public medicine available? There's absolutely not. And they stand there acting like they're helpless. Or in Congress today, you see, okay, this is great, a $1.9 trillion package of economic relief. Most of it, again, goes to the corporations. A tiny fraction goes to working people. A little tiny handout that would pay less than 2 months of rent.
Right.
So this is all hypocrisy on another level, but it is intended to get this through quietly, all by sleight of hand. You'll see a whole series of articles about why this or that weapon needs to be modernized and is part of defense. It's defense of profit. It's not defense of the population
okay.
here.
Let me get Jim back in on this. Jim, you know, Sarah had talked about, when we talked about international agencies, that basically, because the U.S. is powerful, that these other countries are intimidated and go along with the U.S. I want your perspective on that. Is it that they are intimidated, or basically have these international agencies, they've been set up in a way that they're actually less international than more U.S. or Western control to begin with?
Yes, I'll give you one, I think, example that's very relevant to what you mentioned earlier. We are now 40 years, I think it's this very month, we are 40 years since Israel bombed an Iraqi nuclear reactor, which Iraq had bought from France, and had actually supplied to Israel itself, the same basic reactor that supplied to Israel earlier, but they also supplied it to Iraq. And 40 years ago, Israel said, well, if Iraq develops nuclear technology through this nuclear reactor, it wasn't inherently military, it's just a nuclear reactor, then Iraq will have the capacity or increased capacity to go for a nuclear weapons program. So Israel bombed it. And that was a gross, blatant violation of everything that was agreed, especially in 1945 with the conclusion of the Second World War and the setting up of the United Nations and so on. And it's interesting to note that the United Nations Security Council met very quickly after the Israeli bombing and condemned it and said it was a gross violation of the basis of international law and called upon Israel to join the treaties, the NPT, and I think also the International Atomic Energy Agency. And that's how the resolution stood. On the face of it, it looks absolutely clear-cut.
But actually, at the end, nothing really happens.
If I could just finish it. It mandated the Secretary General of the United Nations to report, I think it's every three months, to the United Nations Security Council on the implementation of the resolution. And if anybody wants to do an absurd play, to write it an absurd play, it will consist of the character representing the UN Secretary General going to the UN Security Council every 3 months for 40 years and reporting no progress. That's how they set it up. So you're absolutely right. You have a condemnation by the UN Security Council, unanimous condemnation, and then complete toothlessness, because that's how they wrote the resolution.
Sarah, let me just get Sarah in on this, because we're just about out of time. But Sarah, what does it all mean? If on the one hand, as you've talked about, the massive hypocrisy that we see coming from these entities that have nuclear weapons and even condemning countries that are trying to have a peaceful nuclear program, and then the international entities that have been allegedly set up to balance things are actually under the control of those same countries. So where is all this going? What is the answer to this, Sarah, in your perspective?
I think to place no confidence in the international agencies that are supposedly monitoring this, and no confidence in, I think we should call on UN past resolutions to be respected, but not believe that they will be respected. It's more and more important than ever that the people in the U.S., in Britain, in countries around the world make their own demands on governments that refuse to listen and just refuse to buy into the idea that this has anything to do with defense. The defense contractors, they're called defense, they have nothing to do, as I say, with defense, but Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Northrop, Raytheon, they don't produce anything that people need. They produce a death machine. And it is a death machine that is bankrupting the U.S. and the world. It is a huge theft of resources, and it is pulling, actually, the U.S. and Britain down. The position Britain is in, the U.S. is very close to. It is a decaying empire with unfunctional infrastructure right here. I'm not only in health, but in basic roads and bridges and buildings. Complete deterioration, and all the money is getting pumped into defense.
Okay.
And right here, we become sicker. So I think it's a more important time than ever for people here to speak out for peace, but consciously against the theft of the resources by these corporations.
Okay. And on that note, so sorry to end it, but we're out of time. Appreciate both of you being with us from the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, Jim Brenn out of London, and co-director in